Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 3, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome once again to our Practice Group telephone conference call on the role of state attorneys general in enforcing and defending laws. We're going to hear from two experts today. We're happy to welcome both of them. Their bios have been forwarded to you in the notice you got for today's call. They're also available on our website. So as always, I'm going to be very brief with my introductions. Each is going to give us opening remarks of 8 to 10 to 12 minutes or so. We'll have a little discussion. And then as always, we're going to turn to you for your questions. So please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. We're going to hear first from the Honorable Attorney General John W. Suthers. He is the Attorney General of the State of Colorado. He will be followed by Professor Neil E. Devins, Professor of Law and Professor of Government and Director of the Institute of the Bill of Rights Law at the William & Mary Marshall Wythe School of Law. And with that, let me get out of the way and turn things over to Attorney General Suthers.
Well, thank you, Dean, and my thanks to the Federalist Society for sponsoring this teleforum. I think the history of the Federalist Society and having discussions on pertinent aspects of the law is stellar, and this is just another example of it. I want to start out by saying that for the most part, I am very slow to criticize my brethren state AGs, and I'm certainly slow to criticize the Attorney General of the United States. But I have been very concerned about developments of late where certain of my brethren and encouraged by the Attorney General of the United States have chosen not to defend their state laws, in many instances their state constitutional provisions. And this comes to a head, frankly, in the issue of defending provisions that prohibit same-sex marriage in the states. I think the notion of state AGs picking and choosing what cases to defend in a situation where there has not been an issue that's actually been decided, where the highest court with jurisdiction over the issue has made a decision binding, is very problematic. And I think we have to see it as problematic potentially on all sides of the political aisle. As I look at the cases that I'm defending right now, they span the political spectrum very broadly. For example, my office is in trial right now defending some gun control laws that were passed by the state legislature, the democratically controlled state legislature, last year, a universal background check, a limit of 15 rounds per magazine. I wouldn't have voted for those laws. There are some genuine constitutional issues involved, but I wouldn't think about not defending them. I wasn't a big fan of marijuana legalization in Colorado, but I'm defending a whole bunch of cases involving that process. To be fair, I kind of came up through the law enforcement ranks to be attorney general. I was a district attorney. I was a United States attorney. So I have always seen my role as first and foremost law enforcement. You know, some of my brethren were speakers of the House or president of the Senate and have come to the role of attorney general, and I think may have a different perspective in terms of public policy involvement than I do. But I see myself as first and foremost a lawyer and law enforcer. I think what troubles me the most is that when I have heard this discussion, I haven't heard anyone come up with any generally applicable standard that ought to be applied. As I say, in the 10 years that I've been Attorney General, the only standard that I have come to embrace is, has the issue been decided? And it can be, you know, a direct on-point case or just kind of an obvious situation. If the state of Colorado passed a law that said, you know, every person with blue eyes will be executed, may not have an on-point case, but I can say with a great deal of confidence that that's an unconstitutional law. But absent that, I have a real problem with decisions, some of these decisions that folks have been making. When Attorney General Holder came to the National AG's meeting in February and said he thought it was okay for state AGs not to defend their constitutional statutory provisions on same-sex marriage, the closest thing to a standard was if you think long and hard about it and you come to the conclusion that you think it's unconstitutional, it's okay not to defend it. I'm not sure that's much of a standard. And one of the things that's troubling to me is I have heard some of my brethren articulate why they're not defending it. The legal discussion gets over very quickly. You know, there's something about, I think it's unconstitutional. And then most of the discussion has to do with some consistent phraseology such as, I don't want to be on the wrong side of history. And I can't help but concluding that that's code, if you will, for not, I don't want to be on the wrong side of politics. Clearly, there are strong political winds blowing in the other direction. The states are authorizing same-sex marriage. There's strong legal winds blowing. The district courts are somewhat routinely striking down bans on gay marriage. But even though we've had a decision on DOMA, we have not had a decision on the constitutionality of the state prohibition on gay marriage. And I believe the lawyerly thing to do, lawyers have a role to play, and that's to defend this controversial law. Just as bad people deserve a defense, I think possibly bad laws deserve a defense. And I suspect that one of the arguments that people will make is, well, there are other folks that can defend these laws. Well, that may or may not be true. In the Proposition 8 case out of California, we found that there may not be someone else that can defend the law. To refresh everybody's recollection, the DOMA case went up at the same time as a challenge to Proposition 8 in California, which said marriage is California, I believe, constitutional provision. Says marriage between a man and a woman. That's the exact constitutional provision we have in Colorado. When the federal district court found that statute, that provision unconstitutional, the California Attorney General chose not to appeal it. And when the case got to the Supreme Court said, you know, a group of citizens brought the case, and they said those citizens didn't have standing. And I think that kind of emphasizes why the state attorney general has a role to play. Had California appealed that case, presented it to the court, we likely would have had a resolution of this issue by this time. And I think that's why it's important that AGs play their role. I know, I believe Professor Devins will follow me, will make the point, and I think a correct one, that there may not be a constitutional duty to defend, and I don't disagree with that. I believe that based on my analysis of the organic statutes in Colorado for that outline the responsibilities of the Attorney General, that I have a statutory duty to defend, and I think a lot of other AGs may have a statutory duty to defend, but I'll be the first one to admit that the statutes are different, and there may or may not be a statutory duty to defend. But I guess my point is it's the lawyerly and proper thing to do to defend a law until the issue is resolved. I guess we may discuss later on whether it's different in a unitary system like the federal system for involving the relationship between the president and the attorney general of the United States and a plural executive that we have in most of the states. I guess I would conclude by saying my biggest concern for me is that I think the exercise of what I'm calling an AG veto, which is, you know, only the executive gets a chance to veto laws, and the AG should not be vetoing laws. I think my biggest concern is that this picking and choosing what cases to defend can cause some significant cynicism about the public about the role of the AG. I think the what it says to the public is that this person is just another political player in a political system, and not a legal player in a legal system. And the fact of the matter is there's an awful lot of forces lobbying AGs today. That world's changed dramatically. I kind of think the tipping point was the tobacco settlement. But corporate America's out there, big law firms are out there, and interest groups are out there trying to influence AGs. And, you know, there's no question that a lot of my brethren want to move on to higher office, whether it be U.S. Senate, governor. And I think it creates an impression that, you know, they're more worried about offending their political base than they are worried about doing the lawyerly thing, defending laws until it's resolved. So let me stop there and just say that I think one thing I feel good about is that my op-ed in the Washington Post, which I did in response to a previous op-ed, has garnered some healthy debate, and I think that's good, and frankly, that's certainly what the Federalist Society is all about. So with that, I will turn it over to Professor Neil Devins from William & Mary, who I just met for the first time on the phone, but I think will enlighten us about this whole notion of the duty to defend.
Well, thank you so much, Attorney General, and I appreciate your remarks, and thanks, Dean, for convening this phone call as well. Let me start by saying that I think the Attorney General, in his opinion piece in the Washington Post and his comments today, makes the critical point that I won't take issue with, although I'll take issue with some other points made by the Attorney General, that the issue as it is playing out on the same-sex marriage question is creating public cynicism about state attorney generals with respect to the fact that Democratic attorney generals seem willing to back away and not defend same-sex bans, while Republican attorney generals are consistently defending same-sex bans. And I think this is a problem, and I think the attorney general has called attention to it with his comments today and his opinion piece as well. At the same time, I do want to take issue with a couple of the points made by the Attorney General and also by Attorney General Holder, as it turns out. And then many of these, of course, we can follow up with in the Q&A that goes after my comments. The first is the notion that there should be a general rule. Attorney General Holder said the general rule, if you will, is that state AGs have interpretive independence and need not defend laws they think unconstitutional, and that they should interpret the Constitution as they see fit. And the Attorney General speaks of a general rule of the need to defend unless there is a court ruling directly on point. And I think when it comes to the state, general rules don't work. And the reason for that is that each state has its own legal system, its own constitution, its own set of statutory rules. The Attorney General noted that in Colorado, he had a statutory obligation to defend, and that certainly is true in Colorado, but not every state has that approach. Some states allow their attorney generals to challenge state laws as unconstitutional. Other states do not allow their attorney generals to challenge state laws as unconstitutional. Some states provide backup systems when the attorney general does not defend. Other states, as California does, as the attorney general mentioned, do not have backup systems. So in Virginia, where I live, the state AG is not defending a same-sex marriage ban, but county clerks are defending it. In Kentucky, the state AG is not defending, but the governor is hiring outside counsel to defend. In Pennsylvania, there is actually a statute which says that if the attorney general does not defend, the matter is referred to the governor, and the governor can appoint counsel to defend a statute. So there are great differences among the states in that context. And with respect to the duty to defend, I've taken just a preliminary look at state attorney general opinions, and there's great variety here. In some states, there's simply no interpretive independence. In Louisiana, North Dakota, they need to litigate until a court rules against the state. In some states, like Tennessee, it's left strictly to the state attorney general to do what he thinks is right, along the lines of what Attorney General Holder says. In other states, the practice is to defend unless the law is clearly or patently unconstitutional, which Attorney General Souther suggests means that there's a court ruling on point. But even here, there's a lot of ambiguity as to what is clearly or patently unconstitutional. I did a study with Sai Prakash of the University of Virginia looking at the federal duty to defend, and we looked at cases where the U.S. Solicitor General said a matter was patently unconstitutional and refused to defend, and we discovered that the U.S. Solicitor General often switched positions from one administration to the next, one asserting patently unconstitutional and the other asserting constitutional. So the whole question of how the states should pursue this cannot be dealt with, in my view at least, with a one-size-fits-all solution. There needs to be a recognition that each state has its own legal culture, its own statutory laws, its own constitution, and they will proceed in different ways. So I think that's the main point I want to make in my comments. But I do want to raise one other general issue, and that is the question of judicial supremacy and executive autonomy. At the federal level, and this was the heart of the paper that Sai Prakash and I wrote, the executive is a unitary actor who takes an oath to defend, who has an obligation to take care the laws are faithfully executed, but that means the law must be valid law. And we argue in our paper that there's no duty to defend, nor is there a duty to enforce that would set up an opportunity for a court case. And I think at the state level, that is often but not always true, depending again on the state law. But I think the Attorney General Souther, that is, suggests that it should be left to the courts. Maybe that's not the explicit thrust of his comments. I think the explicit thrust is the idea that we don't want state attorney generals to pick and choose, and that's very important. But if the state attorney generals are consistently defending and the states are consistently enforcing so that you have justiciable controversies, you're essentially saying that this is best decided by federal judges or, in some cases, if it's state law, state judges, as opposed to giving the executive branch, and obviously the state executive branch is different because attorney generals are often elected and independent of governors. So enforce and defend are separated at the state, as unlike the federal government where enforce and defend are merged. But I don't think we should leave it to courts to settle all constitutional questions. I think it's okay for some constitutional questions to be decided by the executive branch, by taking action, which keeps a matter out of court, because I do think there's an obligation to interpret the Constitution through the oath, which not only is taken by federal officials, but is also taken by state officials, such as state attorney generals. So assuming there is interpretive independence in a particular state, I think the choice at that point becomes a choice between do we want executive autonomy or do we want judicial supremacy? And I think the attorney general comments are very useful as to the cost of executive autonomy, but I think there are also costs to judicial supremacy, and we should think about those costs as well. So those will be my general comments, and then we can follow up with the Q&A.
Well, thank you very much, both Professor Devens and Attorney General Souther. I want to get back to Attorney General Souther, but before I do that, let's at least start letting people line up with questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I also want to interject a brief commercial announcement for our Teleform conference calls. Monday at 3 p.m., we're going to be talking about FDA regulation of trans fats, and then next Wednesday at 1 p.m., we'll be speaking with the author of a new book on Shariaism. There are likely going to be some additional Teleforms that are still in the process of being scheduled, so do check back with our website. Again, if you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Attorney General Souther, I want to give you a chance to respond to Professor Devens. So go right ahead, please.
Thanks, Dean. I guess my concern is that, and it may just be rooted in the fact that I'm a little more skeptical than the professor about motivations. If I thought that executive, the governor was, or the attorney general in a plural executive branch, was exercising his interpretive independence free of political versus legal notions, I would be a lot more comfortable with his view of the world. My concern is I know that there are very, very strong political pressures that are taking place here. A lot of political action committee funds at stake, and I think that can distort the integrity of what he is envisioning. And I think that this notion of stepping away and, oh, there's somebody else that can do this, has the ability to create very significant cynicism on the part of the public that this is just nothing but political decisions as opposed to legal and lawyerly decisions. So I guess I'm tinged with some cynicism that comes from my real-world experiences. I don't doubt the fundamentals of what the professor says, but I remain very skeptical about this process we seem to be going through now, where it's the Attorney General of the United States tells state AGs, hey, it's okay not to defend state laws if you think long and hard about it and think it's unconstitutional. Because I think it's a process that is going to be very, very burdened with politics and ultimately produce public cynicism.
We do have three callers with questions at this point. So, Professor Devins, can we go to the callers, or do you want to take a quick minute for a rejoinder there?
Well, just a couple quick things. I think that the Attorney General is certainly correct about political pressures. But at the federal level, and it would be interesting to get his views on the state level, on the federal level, there are many pressures for the Department of Justice to defend federal law and to assert the supremacy of the court in terms of giving the Justice Department more power within the federal establishment. The more the courts have power, the more the Justice Department has power. So the duty to defend, in part, is supported by incentives within the Justice Department. For the state attorney general, I wonder if those incentives are the same or different. In other words, will there be just a couple cases spread out over many years where the attorney general does not defend, so that the concern of General Southers, while real, is going to come up so infrequently, it ought not to undermine the principles of interpretive autonomy. So whether there's a desire to have a reputation of being a person of law as an attorney general, or whether instead state attorney generals, because they're elected, should be seen more as political actors subject to political pressure, and perhaps the rules that govern the Department of Justice at the federal level with respect to the internal pressures just do not really apply at the state level, because state attorney generals are more inherently political than the U.S. attorney general.
Okay, let's turn to the audience now. We've got four callers with questions, so let's take our first question.
Hello, this is Steve Klein from Wyoming, and I have a question for A.G. Southers. What's your opinion on splitting the baby? About a month ago in the case Susan B. Anthony versus Dryhouse, there was the Attorney General of Ohio filed an amicus curiae brief, basically taking a position against the law he has to defend, and then, of course, filed a brief defending the law, and that's happened previously, years ago, decades ago. Then Solicitor General Bork did the same thing with the Federal Election Campaign Act, and both an amicus brief as well as a brief defending the law. What's your position on that?
I I am more inclined towards that than refusal to defend, in the sense that I don't think there's any problem with an AG, and I think the professor's response is, what good is a watered-down defense? But I have less problem with the notion of exposing the weaknesses and saying there is another side to the story, and I, as the AG, admit that there's another side of the story, than simply refusing to defend. I don't think it's the preferred practice, because there's plenty of folks to bring out that other side of the story. But I'm slow to condemn it without knowing the particular circumstances. I think it's very awkward, and as I say, I think the court will get plenty of information on both sides. I'm more concerned about a circumstance where the court really needs to hear from the Attorney General and others are not an appropriate party to the case.
Professor Devins, anything on this point?
I wonder a little bit about the idea of a law being enforced and leaving it to courts to appoint amici to defend when the state attorney general will not defend, which is a practice that sometimes happens at the federal level. So, for example, the Clinton Justice Department would not defend a Miranda override statute, and the Supreme Court asked Paul Cassell to appear on behalf of the proponents of the statute and to defend the statute. And I wonder if that could not happen at the state level, where courts could simply ask amici to make arguments and ask very good amici to make arguments. So a vigorous defense can be launched if the statute were enforced.
Does that help General Suthers if there's if we avoid the standing issue altogether and appoint a capable counsel to substitute for the state attorney general in some sort of
standing? That is, to my knowledge, a very infrequent circumstance in the states. I don't know of a circumstance. It may have happened. I don't think it's ever happened in Colorado. It happens a lot in the feds. I would remind everybody that it was amici counsel who was arguing that the penalty for the individual mandate in the court was in fact a tax, which in hindsight was very interesting to those of us who were the plaintiffs in that case.
All right. Still four questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Mike Stern in Washington. You both mentioned public cynicism as a factor in something that you're concerned about in this process. And I guess my question is, isn't public cynicism entirely warranted in connection with this issue? In other words, if there's a legal question here, is it anything more than a prediction of how Justice Kennedy is going to feel when it gets to the Supreme Court? And why should, maybe state attorney generals should just be honest and say, look, this really has nothing to do with the law. This is a different kind of question, and I'm going to do what, I think is right, or what my political party wants, or whatever, and not try to fool the public into thinking that something else is going on.
I have a real problem with that. As I say, it's pretty apparent where the political winds are blowing on this issue. It's pretty apparent to me, frankly, the way the legal winds are blowing. But for me to simply say, hey, I don't want to be on the wrong side of this when this political wind ceases and the issue is decided, that's just not being a lawyer at all. And I just don't see that as an option. I've got to play a lawyerly role. And I will tell you, in defending the law here in Colorado, I'm not going to get into sociology about kids needing moms and dads and things like that. I'm sure that a lot of groups will. I'm just going to talk about historically and traditionally marriage is defined by the states. This is not something addressed in the Constitution. This is not something that has historically been a federal concern. And our legal argument is going to be let the political processes play out. And so I think there's a big difference between saying let's just accede to the political processes as opposed to making legitimate legal arguments about how the political process should play out. And I forgot to mention something, just to make sure you know that there's all kinds of issues on all sides of this same spectrum. In Colorado, we have civil unions, and we have the legislature created that, and we have a public accommodation law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So at the same time that I'm in court defending the constitutional provision for a ban on marriage between a man and a woman, I am, on behalf of the State Civil Rights Commission, prosecuting a case against a little ma and pa baker in Lakewood who refused to sell cake to a gay couple that wanted to celebrate their marriage in another state. And I got to tell you, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the government telling this little ma and pa baker who they have to sell cakes to, but that is the public accommodation law in Colorado. And I feel an obligation to enforce it. We've won in the trial court. My guess is we'll probably win in the appellate courts. But I want to make sure that, you got to be really consistent here and be willing to defend on all sides if you're going to argue as I have done here about this duty to defend.
Let's take another call.
Thanks for a very good discussion. I have to admit I'm not a lawyer, so if my question is naive, I apologize. It seems to me that this is the basic principle of whether we're a nation of laws and not of men. The attorney general who just gave the example of having to prosecute people who under a law that he's not really comfortable with is a perfect example of elected officials or any civic official having to carry out laws regardless of how they personally feel about them. If you were to turn this around to a number of years ago when laws started being passed about governing the protesters outside abortion clinics, you could imagine the reaction if law enforcement officials just said, well, I'm not going to enforce those. The protesters can go where they want. They can do what they want as long as they don't assault people or threaten them. And that's a perfect example of how all of these laws can be turned against anybody based upon the whim of whoever the official happens to be. So, you can't imagine other officials in any branch of government just being able to decide themselves what they're going to enforce and what they're not going to enforce, which is different than discretion in particular cases. And frankly, again, not being a lawyer, not being an elected official, if they really have that big an issue with it, they should resign in protest and make an example of that. But I find it very frightening, not over this particular issue, but the whole idea that a single man or woman could decide, well, I'm not going to enforce these laws because I disagree with them. I just think that is contrary to our whole system. And thanks again for a great discussion.
If I could start, please. This is Neil Devins. I think the question is an excellent question, but to be a nation of laws includes the Constitution, which has within it the separation of powers and the interpretive autonomy that many state attorney generals have, an obligation to enforce and defend only those laws that are valid laws. So it's not necessarily a question of picking and choosing which laws somebody likes. There may be instances where there is an interpretation of the Constitution, an obligation for the attorney general to adhere to his or her understanding of what the Constitution means and to put that into action, sometimes by refusing to defend. And that is consistent with the idea of a nation of laws. To refuse to defend simply because one disagrees, and I know that's what Attorney General Suthers is most concerned with, is highly problematic. But to refuse to defend on the basis of sincere belief, if one has the interpretive autonomy and independence where one is supposed to act consistent with their understanding of the Constitution, is very consistent with being a nation of law.
It's not the first time that I found non-lawyers asking the most pertinent questions, because I think what that question evidences is this whole problem of public cynicism. Because I do think the public's view of the rule of law is that people don't pick and choose what laws to enforce. And it's fine to get, hyper-legal and say, other people besides the Supreme Court gets to decide what's constitutional, and that was clearly the view of Thomas Jefferson and all that sort of thing. But the vast majority of Americans have bought off on the notion that everybody doesn't get to decide for themselves what's legal and what isn't. If the Attorney General can decide that this law is unconstitutional, does every individual citizen who that's where the sovereign citizen movement comes from, and all that hate mail I get every day that says I don't have to get a driver's license, and, you know, that's what they say. I think this is unconstitutional. I don't have to obey it. And I think this question reflects the fact that to Americans, the rule of law means that people don't get to pick and choose what laws are going to enforce.
Yeah, if I may, you referenced Thomas Jefferson. I think that's an excellent example. Thomas Jefferson thought the alien and sedition laws were unconstitutional. He pardoned individuals convicted under those laws, and he refused to enforce or defend those laws. Had he enforced and defended those laws, they would have been presented to Federalist judges who potentially would have upheld them, and you would have had a situation where the courts would have upheld laws that the president thought were patently unconstitutional, and today, of course, we all think are patently unconstitutional. And it is a question of risk one is willing to take, and what Jefferson did, I think, was right and appropriate.
We've got two questions pending at this point, then our lines are open. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's go to our next caller.
Hello, this is Kurt Levy. Professor Devins, I read your article that you wrote with Professor Prakash, and you make certainly an eloquent argument for why there's no duty to defend or enforce on the part of the executive laws that I think are unconstitutional. I mean, I liked it so much that I cited heavily in my own law review article on the duty to defend, but I respectfully disagree. I mean, I realize that laws vary from state to state, but as a practical matter, I don't see how the separation of powers can survive your view, because the state AG, or on the federal level, the president / attorney general, can basically veto any law they don't like. And it's not even a veto, because a veto is applied before something becomes law. This is after the fact. They can fail to enforce it, or they can undermine it by failing to defend it. You can always find somebody will say virtually any law is unconstitutional. The AG can certainly encourage such a suit, and then by failing to defend it, either completely destroy the law, as we saw with Prop 8 in California, or at least ensure that it doesn't get a very good defense. So basically, you're giving the executive a virtual post-enactment veto power, and you can say, oh, attorney generals will be sincere, they won't abuse it, but what just happened with gay marriage proves otherwise. You have a bunch of attorney generals saying with a straight face, this is clearly unconstitutional, when everyone knows that it's, up for grabs. The Supreme Court specifically said they weren't addressing it in the Windsor decision, and it's probably about 50-50 that, what Kennedy will do. So it's completely insincere. So we have proof that the executive won't be sincere with this any more than Holder was sincere when he said that DOMA was clearly unconstitutional. So, And again, you know, that these laws, even if you completely disagree with it, you know, citizens benefit from a full defense. Attorney General Holder, when he was encouraging the state AGs to sort of make up their own minds on gay marriage, cited, he said, if I was Attorney General of Kansas, I would not have defended the segregation laws. Well, if none of the attorney generals had defended the segregation laws, there may never have been a Brown v. Board. So, you know, not only are you negating the law, but you're also in many cases depriving the public of a full resolution of the issue. So, you know, it has separation of powers issues, not only relative to the legislature, but also to the judiciary. And I'm just wondering if you're, you know, one, what's going to save the separation of powers, and are you prepared to live with the results when, say, a Republican attorney general refuses to defend the public accommodation law that that was just mentioned, saying that it's a violation of religious liberty? And so, you know, a law on the state books that bans discrimination against gays basically withers on the vine because a Republican attorney general won't defend it. I mean, are you prepared to live with that result?
Let me say a few things in response. I very much appreciate the comments, and I appreciate the fact that you read the article that Professor Prakash and I wrote. The first is on the state level. If the state political establishment truly disavows a law, the law will be repealed. At the time of Brown and today, there are enough state political establishments that support the law that even if some states do not defend, other states will defend. So at the state level, I think there will certainly be a hearing irrespective of whether some attorney generals refuse to defend, on at least on issues like same-sex marriage and school desegregation. But that's a small point. Your main point, I think, is more on the federal level and the idea that presidents can effectively exercise a veto. Well, one approach is to say, as Professor Prakash and ISI and I say in our article, is that even if the concerns you articulate make you uncomfortable with our position with respect to the enforcement of laws and taking issues out of court, there's no need to have a duty to defend if the president thinks the law unconstitutional, because there are mechanisms, as I had mentioned before, the attorney general suggested, not often utilized at the state level, but often utilized at the federal level, where you can have the Justice Department refuse to defend but have the government enforce, there's a justiciable controversy, and then a counsel adversary, an amicus, can be appointed to launch a vigorous defense. So a Paul Cassell in the Dickerson case involving the Miranda override statute, or a Paul Clement, assuming that the House couldn't defend itself in the DOMA case, and Clement would have been appointed to articulate a defense of the federal law. So I'm not as worried. And I also think the fact that these cases come up so infrequently speaks to the fact that the Justice Department almost always will defend. And even when it won't, it seems that there's always a judicial resolution and not a situation of a veto. So I think just our history suggests, even when the duty to defend is articulated as a refusal to defend, nonetheless, we see a judicial resolution of the issue, and we don't see the executive veto that you reference. But I think your points are very well made, and in the abstract makes sense. But I think in terms of how this thing has played out and how it could be put forward, I still stand by the argument advanced by Cy and I in our article. But thank you very much.
And I would just add that it has been rare in the past, but one of my concerns is that it won't be now that AGs see that they can get away with it. You know, the rule used to be that AGs followed on the state and federal level was that it had to be patently unconstitutional. But I think that rule has now been weakened by what Holder did and state AGs did, and I hope you're right that it stays rare.
Very good. We've got one question pending at this point. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next call.
Hi, this is Evan Bullock. I'm an attorney in Phoenix, Arizona. What my first question is whether if the court agrees and everything that it's okay for a state attorney general not to defend a law, a state law, because of their own judgment that it's unconstitutional. Does that also give attorney generals the right to not defend a state law just because they think that it's in conflict with any federal law? I know that's a big issue here in Arizona. We've passed medical marijuana legislation, and not only our attorney general, but some county attorneys as well have said that they have no intention of enforcing the law because, in their opinion, it is adverse to just general federal law that bans marijuana. My second question is, if attorney generals do have some sort of right to elect not to defend state laws, is there any recourse by taxpayers that could force the attorney general's office to either pay for someone else to lodge the defense or to compel the attorney general themselves to do their duties under state law and actually defend the law?
Let me take a shot at that. I do think that there are provisions in most state laws that if an AG is unwilling or unable for any reason, conflict or whatever, an outside counsel is appointed, it is typically paid for through the AG's budget. Now, that is an additional expense because it's obviously more expensive to hire outside counsel and things like that. But I think there are typically provisions in law for that. I think your discussion about the federal-state situation is intriguing. And, of course, I've got a state that the citizens by 55-45 vote have legalized the possession of small amounts of marijuana. And I read, you know, I've read some of the stuff that folks have put out that the state law is somehow invalid because of the federal law. I got to tell you, I don't come to that conclusion. Obviously, because of Reich versus Gonzalez, it's very clear that the federal government can say that marijuana that's grown in Colorado, sold in Colorado, consumed in Colorado, is still subject to federal law. It is a matter of impacting interstate commerce. But I don't see how the flip side of that is that Colorado can't do away with its state laws that make marijuana illegal. I just don't come to that conclusion. And, you know, my attitude is Colorado could legalize murder if it wanted to. Why it would, I have no idea. But that's what it did here. But all the federal laws still apply, and it's up to the federal law, to the federal government, whether they want to enforce those laws or not. And we've got kind of, you know, speaking of enforcing laws, we've got this really bizarre situation where the United States Justice Department is now saying by letters, even though all this activity in Washington and Colorado is a violation of federal law, I'm directing federal law enforcement not to enforce federal law if people are in compliance with state law. And then the follow-up to that, I don't know why we don't just change laws anymore, but I guess because of the impasse in Congress, there's a notion we can't change laws. So we've got this problem that marijuana businesses in Washington and Colorado can't do banking in a federally chartered bank. We have a tax scheme that would be very much benefited by these folks operating through a banking system. And instead of Congress passing a law saying it's okay to for marijuana businesses to bank in federally chartered institutions in Colorado and Washington, instead we've got the Attorney General of the United States sending out a letter saying, hey, don't worry about it, banks, even though this is a violation of federal law, we're not going to enforce it. That whole thing seems awkward to me, and I'm just kind of uncomfortable on this whole notion of we're not going to enforce laws on the books. I'm sure, as the professor points out, it's not unique and all that sort of thing, but it's a very uncomfortable situation, and this state AG is starting to weigh in and saying, I don't like this law, I'm not going to enforce it, has me very nervous about the future.
Yeah, if I can make one small comment here, and I agree with the Attorney General on the issue of the authority of states to repeal existing state law, notwithstanding contrary federal law. But one could imagine another attorney general in another state looking at the medical marijuana case and potentially reaching a different conclusion and potentially arguing that there is clear precedent that the federal law essentially preempts the authority of the states to do what Colorado has done, or alternatively, what the Clinton Justice Department did that I referenced before, but there are other examples with other administrations, looking at a federal law and saying that there's clear Supreme Court precedent that suggests that this federal law is unconstitutional. And I wonder if the only way of administering the system suggested by Attorney General Southers is to essentially say that state attorney generals must defend state law until a court rules against them, rather than give the state attorney general any independent interpretive authority to even cite what they think is clear Supreme Court precedent, because of the fact that attorneys have skills with respect to interpreting precedents, and the only way to have a consistent duty to defend is a system by which there's no interpretive autonomy at all by state attorney generals. I think Louisiana actually has that approach, that you have to wait until a court rules against you and otherwise are compelled to defend your law. And I wonder whether that would be a system that Attorney General Southers would support.
I generally would. I don't think, particularly in the state plural executive system, the Attorney General deciding for himself on an interpretive basis whether or not this particular provision ought to be enforced, I would much prefer the system you describe. And frankly, I think that is my system when I read my statutory directives about defending state law.
Looks like we've got time for a final question. Let's go to our last caller.
Professor and General, is there any concern with a duty to defend that in the event that an attorney general feels that law is unconstitutional or is just bad policy for whatever reason, that he might or she might assign the case to not the best attorney in the office or someone who wouldn't mount a full and vigorous defense for the idea of, well, if I put one of my worst attorneys on the case, then there's a higher chance that we'll lose and I'll get my desired outcome.
Let me take a shot at that. I have an office of 450 employees, 275 lawyers. And a big part of my job, I believe, is to attract very good lawyers to this office, keep and motivate very good lawyers. And that would so much undermine my credibility as a lawyer and as attorney general if I were to do something like that. I told you early on in the conversation that we're in court right now defending some gun laws that I'm not a big fan of. I will tell you I've got tremendous lawyers over there doing that case because, my message to my folks, and I can't speak for every attorney general, but I know that most want to have credibility in their own offices. And for me to maintain my credibility as a lawyer with my people, they're going to figure that out if I'm sending bad lawyers over there and not, kind of circumventing this duty to defend. And that's enough for me to make sure that I would never do that. And I hope it is for most of my colleagues.
Professor Devins, you want to weigh in on this point?
I think the Justice Department at the federal level and the state attorney general's offices as well, particularly in this market, are in a position to hire excellent lawyers, and no lawyer, as a matter of professional ethics and just as a matter of personal pride, would ever take a dive that way. Now, at the federal level, it sometimes is true, and I don't know if this happens at the state level, you will see the Solicitor General's office before the U.S. Supreme Court not advancing every potential argument, that is not necessarily done because of skepticism of the law, but perhaps there are certain legal theories that the Solicitor General does not support, even if the Supreme Court might be willing to go along with, and they will advance those legal theories that they are personally comfortable with. I would not call that a failure to defend, but there are, on occasions, failures to make all potential legal arguments, and I suspect that happens at the state level as well.
Very good. We've got a couple minutes left. I think we have exhausted the audience in terms of questions, but let me give each of you just a minute or so to wrap up. Professor Devens, final thought.
I think the risk of political manipulation by attorney generals is very real, and the Attorney General Souther's comments are very effective in making that point. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize differences among state legal systems and the obligations that some state attorney generals have, which may include the obligation not to defend if they have independent interpretive authority, and they're supposed to act against the background of that independent interpretive authority, and a need to recognize that every state, in fact, is different, and every legal culture of each of these states may be different one from the other.
Attorney General Souther's a final thought.
Thanks. I want to thank Professor Devens, as is so often the case in settings like this. I certainly have learned some things and have some perspectives on my thoughts that are benefited by his points. I told you in my opening comments, my biggest concern is the cynicism that will arise if this happens on a widespread basis where state AGs make decisions about whether they should defend laws and simply, you know, say, well, gee, I think it's unconstitutional, and then start making comments along the lines that I also think I'd be on the wrong side of history and things like that. I do think that the possibility of politics playing a huge role in that sort of thing is very very big one, and I just feel very strongly that there has to be some lawyerly discipline in this process, and that's why I think, for the most part, absent a binding precedent, attorney generals should defend their law. I do see some differences between the unitary federal system and the plural executive system, the state. I think the failure to defend by a AG becomes has all kinds of ramifications in terms of whether a governor is going to do it and all that sort of thing. And thank goodness in Colorado, I've got a pretty good understanding with my governor, who's from a different party, that I make those calls, and that for the most part, that call is going to be, I'm going to defend the law until somebody tells me it's unconstitutional.
Well, this has been a particularly good discussion. I want to thank both Professor Neil Devens and Attorney General John Souther's for their participation today. We certainly enjoyed the discussion. To the audience, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Then we'll be talking about FDA regulation of trans fats. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.